Springfield's Talk 104.1. I am Nick Reed, and it is time for our Author of the Week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone, making it possible for us to interview an author every week, and of course, an entire section devoted to our Author of the Week books. It's right, in fact, when you walk in the door, you'll see it right there, from shelf to shelf, books filled up. And the latest is The Dumbest Generation Grows Up. From Stupefied Youth to Dangerous Adults, Mark Bauerlein is with us, and he is senior editor at First Things, where he hosts a podcast, professor emeritus English at Emory University, and author of five books, including The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30, and So They Have Grown Up. I want to welcome you. Thank you, Mark, for being with us this morning. Have things gotten better for them?
Well, Nick, you know, I'll tell you, when I wrote that first book in 2008, The Dumbest Generation, what shocked me was these kids who were going into their bedrooms, shutting the door, and they've got the game going, they've got the TV on, the laptop, they have the phone, they're texting, they're chatting, they're playing, they're pranking, they're gossiping, sending pictures back and forth, and they're building this youth bubble around themselves. It's going to be ever harder for the grown-ups to break into and put a little, you know, history and politics and good literature and music and the more intelligent things in life. I didn't expect that we would end up with millennials at age 30 who are bitter, disappointed. They have high rates of job dissatisfaction. They rate high on levels of depression, anxiety, narcissism. I mean, Nick, who would have thought that if we handed them a tool that let them take 250 photos of themselves and carry it around in right. their pockets when they were 16, that they would become narcissists? Good boy.
Never would have seen that coming.
Yeah, and they suicide rates are up. And this is before the pandemic hit, which has only aggravated so much. And they were, you know, in 08, they were celebrated as this ambitious, educated, informed. They were going to college in record numbers. They had great social attitudes of tolerance and very progressive. They helped elect our first African-American president. Well, now, when you examine their social attitudes, they rate the highest on intolerance. They have a lot of social mistrust, as social scientists call it. They suspect fellow citizens and fellow workers, and they have a vindictive sense of life, so that if they see an injustice of some kind, some microaggression or some racial joke told, they really want the culprit to be punished. And this is why they are the leaders of cancel culture in the United States today.
So how does technology connect to that? I mean, is just technology one of the many symptoms that much like this attitude that they have, or is it the cause of it? Is there any direct connection?
Well, I think that adolescents have always been this way. I mean, when I was 17, I knew it all, and I didn't want to listen to my parents, and I didn't want to have to sit there while Walter Cronkite, you know, talked about Watergate but I couldn't check out. I couldn't get on the phone. There was only one phone in the house. It was in the kitchen. You had to put your finger in these holes and turn a dial seven times. And so I was forced to sort of be exposed to grown-up stuff. Now, what the technology did for the young is create a social universe that never stops. I mean, I when I went home at night, social life pretty much ended. They would go home at night and social life would ramp up because of all the tools that they had, all the connections. I mean, when they started, but by 2010, they were averaging 3,300 texts sent per month. They were still doing all the phone calls as well. And that this was wholly new. Never before had peer contact, peer pressure been 24/7. Like this. And it was a great social experiment, and it gave them a false sense of reality, because that bubble they lived in the bedroom Nick, that was a wonderful place. It was fun. It was all about them and their age group. They could do jokes. They could gossip. It could go on for hours. I mean, that was really a nice universe to occupy. And the thing is, they grow up 30 years old. And then why does life have to be different? Why can't I live like all those six kids in Friends TV show from the 90s who were really 32-year-olds living like 19-year-olds? Why can't I have that as well? You know, but because life isn't like that. They grew up with illusions, and now they're disillusioned and they're angry about it. And so they're willing to, you know, sign a petition with 2,000 others to get some stranger fired from a job. When in November 2016, Donald Trump won, they weren't just upset, as people do when they lose an election. They were traumatized by it. And you want to say, do you think you get to win every time? This is politics. Sometimes the bad guys are going to win. And the way you face that is you say, okay, we're going to get them next time. We're going to organize. But no, it was a gigantic temper tantrum. And Donald Trump was a perpetual trauma. And then they went two to one for Biden to get him out. And this is where the danger comes in. This isn't healthy in a pluralistic society like the United States is. You know, we have free speech. We have the First Amendment. They don't like free speech. It's disagreeable. They were able to shut out bad speech in their bedrooms. What they didn't want to deal with, they could just turn it off. Why can't they do this in real life? This is the problem, Nick. And technology has only aggravated, again, these ordinary natural youth impulses. They were weaponized. They were armed. They were bolstered like never before by the tools.
We're talking with our author of the week, Mark Bauerlein. The dumbest generation grows up from stupefied youth to dangerous adults. I've always thought of it as that technology, and touching on what you're saying here, I think, is something that it stunted emotional growth. But listening to you, it sounds as if it didn't just stunt the emotional growth, but it took that suspended immaturity and almost gave it power. Is that correct?
I think that's exactly, you know, I didn't quite put it that way, but I think you put it better than I did, Nick. Because remember, these tools were designed by masters in Silicon Valley with the help of experts in addiction and attention and what they call persuasive design. They designed the sites to reach these kids not just as sort of passive couch potato TV watchers. They really wanted to activate powerful impulses inside them the same way a drug, you know, gets the dopamine rush going. And this is why the Silicon Valley titans, they don't let their kids do it much.
Right.
Their own kids do it much. I mean, Steve Jobs famously didn't let his kids get online all the time. The schools like the Waldorf schools in Silicon Valley, they're very popular because they are low tech. You remember the old digital divide in the 90s? Oh, the rich kids are going to have all the access and it's going to aggravate the achievement gap. We got to get poor kids connected to the internet. Well, now we have the opposite digital gap. We have seen screen time explode for low-income kids in the last 10 years. And actually, they're online a lot more than upper-income kids, and that is reflected in test scores. The more time they spend online, the lower their achievement in math and reading scores. Smart thing is, pull them away. Get them away from these tools, because these tools just they hit the consumption button. They hit the social youth stuff button. You can go, there's great stuff on YouTube, right? Educational stuff. You know, I would show to my classes Jack Kerouac reading from his novel on the Steve Allen Show from 1959 or so. It's fantastic. But that's not what the tools mean to 15-year-olds. They mean contact with other 15-year-olds. That's the part that really counts. And so the tools appeal to narcissism, to ego, to the outrageous thing, right? To sensationalism, to spectacle. That's media. That's what they use them for, and that's what Silicon Valley wanted them to use it for, because the more our kids are hooked to the screens, the more money they make.
I understand, I think most people, whether want to admit it or not, why parents allow their children to use the devices. One, because a lot of parents do it themselves, but two, it's an easy babysitter, if you will. It keeps them occupied. But you make, right. I want to talk about this, the education component to this, because that is a very fascinating point, and unsurprisingly runs counter to the way it seems that the government wants to do things, where the more digital exposure, the worse the education level appears to be. And they sell this, oh, we got to get high-speed internet to all these rural areas. We have to do this all in the name of education so that we don't leave anyone behind. But why do the schools not clamp down on this stuff? It seems as if they have a difficult enough time keeping kids' attention anyway. I know here locally, and this has been a national deal, where some of these challenges have occurred to where they've had to remove doors off bathrooms and soap dispensers because of these challenges. And it's all for the point of filming it and putting it on TikTok or social media. So many problems come from the existence of these phones. So while I understand how parents can easily, like, oh, here, I don't want to deal with you, play on this iPad, it seems to be something that is makes life more difficult for educators, yet they seem to embrace it. Why is that?
Well, when the state of Maine did its laptop program in what, 2001, 2002, Apple gave Maine $1 million.
Yeah, money.
To do digital training for their teachers. Now, you know, politicians, they don't like to turn down money. The governor boasted of this as one of his great accomplishments. Apple has a lot of money. All of these tools and these components, they often would be donated to the school systems. And then they actually did a great propaganda number by saying, look, if your kids aren't connected, they're going to be left behind. You're going to see test scores go down, and you are going to take the heat for that. And, you know, the education world has a predilection for novelty. You got to be innovative. Mm-hmm. You got to get out on the cutting edge. Don't be a reactionary. Don't be old-fashioned. I mean, education has a love affair. The education world in our country has a love affair with the next thing, the new advance, right? The best practices that people are doing today. And, you know, when you look at businesses, they don't complain that kids don't have, you know, keyboard skills. Young workers can't read and write well. Those are 19th century skills, yeah. Not 21st century skills. But the education system, they bought into it. When I gave lectures after the Dumbest Generation first book came out, it was interesting. I'm trashing the technology in the hands of the young. Nick, never did I have an engineer or a STEM math and science person say, oh, you're an old-fashioned Luddite. They actually liked this message of these tools getting in the hands of the young and being used in stupid ways and realizing, yeah, this is a problem. I got heat from education people and humanities people because it sounded like I was criticizing kids, and they didn't like that. So they actually bought hook, line, and sinker the idea of the kid with a Facebook page and who is doing Wikipedia entries and has the latest device and forming networks and chat groups. They actually romanticized that child figure far beyond that figure's actual talents. because that you know, educators can be sentimental about youth in that way.
Yeah, I want to ask you last question, I think, anyway, for our author of the week, Mark Bauerlein, The Dumbest Generation Grows Up, How Stupefied Youth, or From, rather, Stupefied Youth to Dangerous Adults. And you write about literacy classics and how young people can learn important lessons. It's not just like learning for the sake of learning, but there's actual growth there. And you write about the discovery of literature in Malcolm X's life and that transformation. Will you talk about that a bit?
You know, Malcolm X goes to prison and he's a thug. He's a slimeball street hustler. And he goes to prison. He gets caught as part of a theft ring that he was the head of. He gets caught. He goes to prison. He gets, I think, a 7-year term. And he realizes in prison, you know, I've got a working vocabulary of about 200 words. And every sentence is profanity. And there are a couple. There's a man in here who's older, black. He speaks carefully and thoughtfully. He's got a good vocabulary. And everyone respects him. Even the white guards respect this man when he talks. And it made Malcolm Little look at himself and say, I must change. And he started trying to read books. And he realized, I don't have the vocabulary. So he started copying the dictionary page by page, every single entry. He ended up spending years reading, doing the whole dictionary, reading, reading, reading. He read so much that he ruined his eyes. He didn't wear glasses before he went into prison. He had to because he ruined his eyes. He spent so many hours. He'd read at night by the little light coming through the window. And it was history, philosophy, religion. And it changed him. He became Malcolm X because he found understanding and it gave him purpose and meaning, a framework that made some kind of sense in his life. And I hold this up as this is how you must transform yourselves. Millennials, you're 30 years old, you're miserable, you're bitter. Read books, find meaningful characters, great stories of love and betrayal and rejection and honor and dishonor. Read about the climactic moments of history when Caesar crossed the Rubicon. What happened at Gettysburg, and then what Lincoln said afterwards. These are the material. Read the Sermon on the Mount over and over again. These are the materials of a better life, a more meaningful life for yourself. That's why I close the book with the story of Malcolm X, which is, I think, one of the most extraordinary conversion stories in all of American history. He went into prison, and they all called him Satan, and he liked that. Yeah. I'm Satan. And then he comes out this actually well-spoken, wearing a coat and tie, thoughtful, and he looks at other people, white people, even racist people, and he wants to understand them. He wants to know what's going on in their heads. And he has that's one of the things that made him such a charismatic figure. He would look at people. And he'd try to see deep into their motives, understand their experience. Millennials don't do that. They hear something that they don't like. You're racist. That's sexist. This is not contributing to a healthy public square. This is not the way to deal with your fellow citizens. But this is where we are.
Well, based on your recommendation to millennials, I'm going to ask a bonus question. If we have parents or grandparents out there listening, I have a 13-year-old now, there are these worries, these concerns. If there were three books that you would say, have your child read these three books as a good starting place, what would they be?
Boy, that's a very tall order.
Yeah, especially off the cuff.
I think actually reading the first chapters of Genesis in the Bible and reading one of the Gospels, maybe start some of the Psalms in the Bible, not the whole Bible, just some good passages in the Bible. I'm going to actually say the autobiography of Malcolm X. I think that is a great book for young people to read. And then what you might consider is reading the poetry of Emily Dickinson. Oh. How's that? Some of those poems
like
of Emily Dickinson.
That's great.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Things like this. Those are my three recommendations.
Right? I love it. No, that's great. Our author of the week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone, Mark Bauerlein, The Dumbest Generation Grows Up, From Stupefied Youth to Dangerous Adults. Thank you, sir. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Nick.
Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed.